This is Susan Livingston, your global extreme weather reporter from the former Extinction Radio, evolving to a more general format covering not only extreme weather events and climate change, but also other anthropogenic drivers of habitat destruction, ecological collapse, and consequent extinction. This is the report for the week ending 6 May 2016. After an April hiatus on SoundCloud, I'm happy to launch this podcast at Panina 3.0. That's PANINA.org, as in Peace and Nonviolence in Action. That's where this podcast will be archived under the Expressions of Peace radio tab. Expressions of Peace TV, personal, powerful, and heart-to-heart, was launched as a project of the Unity Peace Film Festival in Berkeley, California in 2009 and incubated by United Media Productions in 2010 before being adopted by Panina 2.0. Expressions of Peace Radio is still personal, powerful, and heart-to-heart as we focus on coming to a place of acceptance of the consequences of our actions at the individual, community, cultural, and species level. I'll still use extreme weather as the organizing principle of the weekly podcast, which will be known henceforth as Sequitur, for the song of the same title by Zimft. I'll feature the song in its entirety, without the voiceover, at the end of the show. From the way I've been reporting week after week on the heatwave conditions in India and Southeast Asia, perhaps you won't be surprised to learn that I have loved ones in Nagpur, Maharashtra, India, one of the hottest inhabited places on the planet. After Santini's first birthday later this month, her daddy Ashwin plans to move his wife Imola and their daughter back to Bengaluru, where he works and where the physical habitat is a bit more amenable to human life and the social habitat a bit more respectful to his European wife and their mixed-race daughter. I'm asking for a place in your heart for this young family as representatives of all those who are suffering from heat and thirst and separation and loss. Russia Today reports that more than 300 people died of heat-related illnesses in India in April as temperatures exceeded 44 C. That's 111 Fahrenheit. And May is predicted to be worse as El Niño lingers and stalls the onset of the monsoon. The Center for Holistic Development reports that 244 people died on the streets in the month of April, 80% of whom were homeless, and half of the homeless deaths were heat-related. Rivers, lakes, and dams have dried up, and reservoirs are down to about 22% of capacity on the average, which means that water must be trucked in by tanker in the hardest-hit areas. Daytime cooking was banned in the eastern part of the country after 79 villagers died in an accidental kitchen fire. The Times of India calls for protection and conservation of natural water storage systems, such as rivers, lakes, and wetlands, and more investment in water reservoir capacity. As if the heat wave and drought aren't enough of a challenge, almost 900 hectares of India are currently having forest fires. With water reserves reduced to 2 to 3%, the Maharashtra drought has been blamed on negligent administration and poor water management in addition to extreme weather events and inadequate rainfall, reports First Post. The state government has banned the digging of bore wells below 200 feet. In the first 3 weeks of April, 65 farmer suicides were reported in the state. On 26 April, the High Court asked the state to immediately cut water supply by 50% to liquor firms and by another 10% from 10 May. The court also increased the water cut to 25% to other industrial units starting 20 May. Finally, in order to conserve water, the Agricultural Ministry restricted cane production and banned the building of new sugar mills for the next 5 years. RT also reports that in the past 2 weeks, some 50 stations in Thailand have broken heat records with temperatures as high as 44.6 C. Cambodia and Laos also broke records with temperatures as high as 42.6 C and 42.3 C, respectively. Together with Malaysia, Vietnam, and Singapore, the regional death toll is in the hundreds. The head of the Thai Meteorological Department's weather forecast division said, quote, "We've broken the record for the highest temperatures over the longest duration in 65 years, and the season isn't over yet," unquote. In Vietnam, half of the rice crop has been ruined by saltwater intrusion, and there are 500,000 people without adequate drinking water, while hotels, schools, and hospitals struggle to maintain clean water supplies. Vietnam's National Hydrometeorological Forecast Center says climate disruption will look like scantier rainfall during monsoon seasons and more rain during the dry season, along with longer, hotter summers, reports Vietnam Plus. One person and two cows were killed by two separate lightning strikes as severe storms struck in Cambodia last weekend, reports the Khmer Times. The Big Wobble reports that 65 metric tons of dead fish washed ashore in Cambodia over the course of 2 days last weekend, bringing the global total to about 200 metric tons, mostly in India, Southeast Asia, and South America. Quote, "The era of hydroelectricity as an alternative source of energy may be a thing of the past, because water is now becoming too precious to be used to generate power," close quote, says the Philippine Star. Editor of the BizLinks column Ray Gamboa continues, quote, "Just like oil, water can now be abused to the detriment of mankind. But unlike oil's more abstract effect on global warming, water shortages strike directly and deeply into a human's gut," close quote. Cebu Daily News reports that if La Niña follows El Niño, the situation could go from bad to worse, with drought and heat wave replaced by flooding and pest invasions. They put the total economic impact at more than $10 billion across Southeast Asia. So it was a breath of fresh air to read the following assessment of global trade treaties such as the Trans-Pacific Partnership that are currently being pushed through the U.S. Congress. Quote, "When the top emitting countries, United States, China, and India, for example, are busy taking each other to court for supporting renewable energy investments and effectively preventing them from going forward, this significantly hampers our ability to tackle global warming and ramp up the necessary renewable energy to transition the grid," close quote. That's from Fortune, mind you, not from some tree-hugger troublemaker tabloid. Authors Michael Shank and Carolyn Kaysane conclude, quote, "The planet does not have time to witness more stalled sustainability measures scuttled by trade texts and WTO tribunals," close quote. Along similar lines, London-based International Institute for Environment and Development researcher Sarah Cullenbrander questions the administration by the not-for-profit industrial complex of the $100 billion in annual contributions, voluntary, of course, from the Green Climate Fund for Relief and Adaptation that was established at the COP-out 21 and promised by 2020, reports Reuters. Cullenbrander says that in order to get more of the proceeds into the hands of communities, rich country consultants and organizations must step back from their positions as gatekeepers. She recommends a graduated set of accreditation standards that would lower the availability bar by taking the amount of the request into account in addition to more conventional accountability indicators. At least 7 people have been killed and another 121 injured after a 5-month-old low-income apartment building collapsed during heavy rains in Nairobi, Kenya, reports the International Business Times. An audit ordered by President Uhuru Kenyatta last year found that 58% of buildings in Nairobi were unsafe, and the Architectural Society of Kenya estimates that as many as half of the new structures in the city do not conform to basic safety standards. According to the New York Times, Senegal has already warmed 2°C since 1950. A rapper named Matador uses his art to appeal to young Senegalese not to join the migration to Europe, but to stay home and build their country. Yet in his quiet moments, he wonders how he can expect anyone who is physically able to leave to stay and live in, quote, uninhabitable but fully inhabited slums. People are living anywhere there are 4 walls and a dry enough floor, unquote. He attributes the refugee crisis to, quote, a toxic brew of government failures, overpopulation, and extreme floods and droughts, close quote, and points out that the government recently spent millions on a new sports stadium but has no money for storm drains and sewer systems. The United Nations warns that the world may face a 40% shortfall in water availability by 2030, reports Interpress Service. International Policy Director Darcy O'Callaghan at Food and Water Watch said that the global water crisis must be addressed in two ways in tandem, by providing affordable access to safe, clean, sufficient water for all, and by not drawing on watersheds beyond their natural recharge rate. To keep water affordable, she pointed out, it must cost no more than 3% of a family's income, and it must be managed by a public entity, not a private for-profit one. Privatization of water, quote, is a recipe for disaster. Profit should not be the priority when it comes to providing water and sanitation services to people, close quote, because doing so results in violation of basic human rights, poor service, higher rates, and degraded water quality. Yet financial institutions like the World Bank and regional development banks often require developing countries to privatize these systems as a condition of funding. Remember that freak storm in the United Arab Emirates a couple months ago? The UAE is using groundwater reserves more than 20 times faster than they can be recharged by their aggressive cloud seeding operations, which were deployed 4 times as frequently in the first quarter of 2016 than during the same period last year, reports Gulf Business. The UAE currently obtains 50% of their water from groundwater extraction, 37% from desalination, which costs some 60 times as much, and 12% from recycling. At current rates, aquifers are expected to be depleted within 50 years. Last week's second annual U.S. Caribbean Central American Energy Summit revealed that far from growing complacent with oil prices down, the Eastern Caribbean is using the price lull to divert funds into development of carbon-free energy sources such as solar and wind, according to the Montserrat Reporter. Dominica, Grenada, Montserrat, St. Lucia, St. Kitts and Nevis, and St. Vincent and the Grenadines are even exploring geothermal energy. The planet's core heat delivers a clean, limitless, and continual supply of energy along a string of mountains and active volcanoes in Latin America. It provided 13% of Costa Rica's electricity in 2015, reports Reuters. Costa Rica got 73% of its energy from renewables in 2015 and plans to increase that figure to 100% by 2021. The country used zero fossil fuels for energy generation for 255 consecutive days in 2015. Mexico got 18% of its energy in 2015 from renewables and 2% from geothermal, but it expects to increase these amounts to 35% and 10% by 2024. Due to a controversial law passed in 2014 that allows private investors to enter the energy market. The Tico Times also reports on a proposal to excuse some 25 water-efficient water tanks, faucets, shower heads, dishwashers, washing machines, and toilets from import, sales, and selective consumption taxes. The southeastern Australia state of Victoria had gale-force winds and 7-meter swells as a cold front moved in and shaved 7 degrees Celsius off the temperature in less than 2 hours last Tuesday, reports the Geelong Advertiser. A report published last week by the Royal Society of New Zealand says that the country is capable of doing more than the 11% emissions reduction below 1990 levels by 2030, that they promised in Paris. The Cop-Out 21 promise is especially lame from a country that has increased emissions by 42% since 1990, mostly in the transportation and agricultural sectors, and has been meeting its obligations under the Kyoto Accord by trading in Russian and Ukrainian carbon credits that are not actually backed by emissions reductions. In addition to reform of this piece of greenwashed corruption, the report recommended the following. New Zealand's original emissions reduction target of 90% by 2025 is technically and economically possible and could be even higher. Emissions from transport could be reduced by at least 60% by improving urban design policy to encourage biofuels and electricity from renewables, electric vehicles, and use of buses, light rail, cycling, and walking. Freight should shift from road to rail and sea. Emissions from buildings could be reduced by improving insulation, retrofitting, and integrating renewable energy and heating systems. Negative greenhouse gas emissions could be achieved by coupling carbon dioxide capture and storage with use of bioenergy. Emissions reductions will depend on reduced meat and milk production. Increasing the land area of plantation forests could offset up to a quarter of total greenhouse gas emissions over the next 2 to 3 decades. In addition to reforming the New Zealand emissions trading scheme, all policies, targets, regulations, infrastructure, and market settings should be developed systematically to support low-carbon choices by businesses, cities, and households. Bianca Jagger offered a probing critique of the Paris Accord in Huffington Post. While it scales up from the Kyoto Protocol and is a vast improvement over the lame Copenhagen Agreement in that it asks all parties to take action, she recognizes that even if everyone does what they say they will do, the outcome will be 3.7C, close to twice as much as the politically agreed-upon limit, and far more than twice as much as the scientifically agreed-upon limit. Quote, "By now we all know that a 2C target is woefully inadequate," close quote, says Jagger. She calls for a firm commitment by governments to eradicate fossil fuels from our energy systems and leave it in the ground. She says, quote, "Much as I applaud the historic diplomatic achievements the agreement represents, the treaty contains fatal flaws that threaten us and the planet. This is the most important treaty the world has ever known. World leaders should have come away with an agreement that is bold and ambitious enough to save us from climate catastrophe," close quote. She calls the transition to renewable energy urgent and necessary, and cites Denmark, who can produce significantly more than it needs on a windy day, and Mexico, who gives it away to citizens between 9 p.m. and 6 a.m., as illustrative of the economic advantage to people of running the grid on renewables. In his article Cop Out in Paris, published in Resurgence and Ecologist magazine, Herbert Girardet says, quote, "While the world's governments have signed on the dotted line, the world's companies have not. As long as fossil fuel energy is cheaper than renewables, oil, gas, and coal will be dispensed by the energy companies and burned by us all in vast quantities," close quote. The International Energy Agency reports that subsidies for fossil fuels totaled $20 billion in the U.S. and $550 billion worldwide, and that those subsidies have increased by 35% in the U.S. under the current administration, reports Fortune. They also note that the energy sector stands with Big Pharma and the insurance industry as the top three funders of the American corporatocracy, and the cost of habitat destruction by oil, gas, and coal is already 10 times the subsidy amounts, and can only increase as long as the overdeveloped nations continue to support their addictions. That's taxpayer dollars, mind you. It doesn't take account of the millions and billions per year in total settlements that corporations are ordered to pay under the rubric of holding them accountable. In the private sector, insurance claims in Canada from Easter weekend's ice storms have topped $35 million, reports CTV. This is for cleanup of tree debris and for sump pump failures due to power loss, not from injury or loss of life. Also note that this is the amount of claims, not of settlements, which will no doubt be significantly lower. A report back from arguably the largest Earth Day celebration in the U.S. was offered by Huffington Post Green. The bad news is that the concession stands were dominated by junk food and beef because, according to Earth Day Texas founder Trammell Crow, use of contracted concessions was a condition of use of the venue. Here are some of the good news highlights from the event. The event took place in the heart of Texas oil and gas country on the 23-acre Dallas Fair Park, yet the oil and gas industry had no displays. On the other hand, the so-called Green Republicans were very visible with promotion of a carbon tax. Leilani Munti, the only woman in the oil-intensive sport of race car driving, was very vocal about her solar-powered pit and her refusal to accept sponsorship from the industry. Lines were by far the longest at the tiny house display. The Environmental Media Association is pushing the entertainment industry to own and reduce its footprint, especially regarding plastic bottles and the enormous amount of waste on the set. Michael Hoffman, executive director of the Cornell Institute for Climate Change and Agriculture, says heavy precipitation events are up 72% in the central agricultural region of the state of New York, reports WSKG. Alternately hotter and colder, wetter and drier weather with longer growing seasons, quote, have implications and direct impacts on farming. We have more pests than we used to have in the past because they can survive over winter, unquote. With $1.4 million in state funding, the Institute is working with 11 projects, including the use of cover crops planted between the rows when the corn is knee-high. This practice retains soil fertility and prevents it from washing out in heavy rain. A new study reported in the Journal of the American Meteorological Society finds that, quote, reduced summer sea ice favors stronger and more frequent occurrences of blocking high-pressure events over Greenland, unquote, which compromise the jet stream and affect weather both upstream in North America and downstream in Northern Europe, reports Think Progress. A study by the National Center for Atmospheric Research, published in Global Biochemical Cycles, projects that oceanic oxygen depletion already underway will reach alarming levels by 2030, reports Nature World News. Cold water holds more dissolved gases than warm water, and Slate adds that warming increases stratification due to thermal expansion, which reduces mixing of oxygen-rich water closer to the surface with water at greater depths that has less dissolved oxygen. Effects on the metabolism of aquatic organisms and on the biogeochemical processes of the ocean itself are already measurable in the southern Indian Ocean, in parts of the eastern tropical Pacific, and in the Atlantic. This example of big-picture habitat degradation is in addition to the increased carbon dioxide level, which is responsible for the acidification that causes coral bleaching. Widespread storms with golf-ball to baseball-sized hail swept through parts of East Texas and Oklahoma last weekend, killing a 62-year-old woman and her four grandchildren and damaging numerous buildings and trees. Tornadoes touched down in Texas and Oklahoma. Traffic, including railroads and airplanes, was severely affected. Some 8,000 people lost power, and a 32-kilometer stretch of interstate highway was shut down. Louisiana, Mississippi, and Arkansas were also affected. The Sun-Herald reports almost 10,000 homes lost power in southern Mississippi last week, and residents close to rivers were encouraged to evacuate. Schools had late start schedules, and some were closed due to flooding. A state of emergency was declared in Gulfport due to flooding of homes. Farther north, predicted tornadoes didn't materialize. Some parts of the northern Great Plains had snow, reports WSAU. Speaking of habitat degradation, it would seem from my reading about the unheard-of cancellation of a handful of the 47th Annual Jazz and Heritage Festival events and some sporting events in New Orleans due to severe thunderstorms and heavy rain, that the subsidence that has been costing the Louisiana Gulf Coast an area the size of a football field daily has worked its way inland enough to affect the city that forgot to care. I mean the city that care forgot. While its city streets have always been notorious for potholes, there has never been one like the commerce-crippling 30-foot cave-in on world-famous Canal Street described by WDSU, who reported another major sinkhole in a different, less economically important part of town 2 days earlier that was attributed to leaky water pipes and heavy rain. April 2016 has been one of the 10 wettest months in history, with 25 centimeters of rain. In a city in Hurricane Alley with a history of torrential rainstorms, in a city with such a shifting substrate that buildings don't have basements and the dead are buried above ground, the mayor has attributed the cave-in to the impact of leaky water pipes on a nearby tunnel? Say what? In an unprecedented event some 3 decades ago, there was a major seagrass die-off in Everglades National Park in southern Florida. Now that unprecedented event is happening again, reports the Washington Post. Construction of homes, roads, and cities has choked off the flow of fresh water, says Florida International University marine scientist James Forkeren. In addition to drinking water for some 6 million people, sport fishing, worth $1.2 billion annually, is at stake. Meanwhile, in the Follow the Money department, The Hill reports that Florida's Governor Scott is on tour in California in the wake of the latter's recent passage of a $15 minimum wage to try to lure businesses to relocate to his state, where the minimum wage is lower and emission standards are more lax. Telsur reports that the so-called Great Garuda Project, a $40 billion development in Jakarta, Indonesia, population 30 million, has been halted due to allegations of corruption by contractors who were to have built a massive commercial zone on 17 artificial islands off the North Shore, where the local shantytown tracts can be found. Quote, "It is estimated that all of North Jakarta will sink below sea level by 2030, close quote, President Joko Widodo said at a cabinet meeting. Quote, "Because of that, the development of the capital's seaside, which has been delayed for so long, is the answer," close quote. And what was the question? Probably due to a translation error, it is likely that Telsur is misquoting Widodo as saying, quote, "that large parts of the nation's capital could sink below sea level unless a U.S. $40 billion construction project mired by accusations of corruption does not go ahead." Say what? I swear I read it at least a dozen times. Let me read it again. "Large parts of the nation's capital could sink below sea level unless a U.S. $40 billion construction project mired by accusations of corruption does not go ahead." That's what it says. Tangier Island, Virginia, population 450, is a 768-acre island off the coast of the Chesapeake Bay's eastern shore. According to WTVR, it is estimated that the island will be uninhabitable by mid-century due to sea level rise, coastal erosion, and severe weather events. The island's western coast was protected by a seawall in 1989, but wave action is rapidly eroding the northern coast. Instead of fighting a losing battle, the community has been abandoned there, and the town and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers agreed that the best plan was to build a jetty on the west side of the island to enclose the mouth of the interior harbor. But in spite of the 2012 charade of a dedication ceremony for the $4.2 million project, and in spite of successful and timely funding for an upgrade for the K-12 school and a new health center, the jetty project has been tabled for 2 years of further study. Residents are understandably disillusioned with gridlock politics and, quote, "are in the right place to be fired up by an outspoken outsider," unquote. Without naming names, I'll report that there are lots of Make America Great Again yard signs on homes and businesses, and the people have a very strong record for voter turnout, and are prepared to elect a more impulsive candidate, even one they personally don't like, who will see to their habitat needs before throwing money at lost causes abroad, one who will protect their share of the shellfish market from foreign competition. The New York Times reports that a $48 million grant for the resettlement of climate refugees has been awarded to the indigenous United Homa Nation and the Biloxi Chitimacha Choctaw people of Ile de Jean Charles to relocate them from the land that has supported untold generations of their ancestors, but which has now subsided into the rising and ever more violent and toxic Gulf of Mexico. Since 1955, more than 90% of the land area has been lost to channel engineering to serve timber and oil resource extraction, and the people can no longer pursue their traditional fishing, trapping, and hunting lifestyle. The once lush tracts of banana and pecan have succumbed to inundation and salination due to the crippling of the rivers that can no longer replenish the land with their sediments. The built environment has succumbed to mold and rust, and the people have been forced to adopt a commuter lifestyle to sustain themselves. This is the first grant of its kind to be applied in the continental 48 states, but it won't be the last. And stand warned, taxpayers, relocation will cost a lot more for complex, overdeveloped urban centers such as southern Florida than for a village of indigenous people, population 60. A master plan that is expected to cost tens of billions of dollars envisions improving infrastructure and fortification, such as providing better drainage and building giant flood walls, but Île de Jean-Charles would be left on the outside. And I can't help wondering how many tens of trillions it would cost to build and maintain such a system for all of the threatened coastline to provide what is, in the end, a temporary fix. What's the solution? Give the wounded land back to the earth for healing? Accept the consequences of our actions? Give up the myths of equality and consensus and support both the people who want to leave and the people who want to stay, no strings attached. And we were warned, reminds the Homeland Security News Wire in an article in their Emerging Threats column titled A Rising Tide of Migration. The first report of the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change warned us in 1990 that, quote, these changes could initiate large migrations of people, leading over a number of years to severe disruptions of settlement patterns and social instability in some areas, close quote. Michael Gerard, director of the Sabin Center for Climate Change Law, notes that, quote, a place becomes uninhabitable well before it's submerged, close quote. Eric Holthaus, writing for the Columbia Law School magazine, says, quote, the humanitarian crisis phase of climate change has officially begun. In total, climate change may displace up to 250 million people by 2050, according to research cited by the Office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, close quote. How is it that the distinction between a migrant and a refugee is so hard for people like Homeland Security and the IPCC to recognize and respect? Meanwhile, the New York community of Red Hook saw the flood protection funding they were awarded in January 2014 in the wake of Hurricane Sandy cut in half, reports DNA Info. Even as residents watch more economically important areas get more than three times the funding. Too bad they're in New York and not in Delaware, where we saw 4 weeks ago that leftover Hurricane Sandy relief funding was being redirected to the restoration of eroding beaches to their economically optimal condition for the tourist industry. And as if to add insult to injury, proposals for an increase in funding have nothing to do with improving infrastructure, but focus instead on relief for homeowners from skyrocketing insurance premiums. It sounds to me like subsidies at taxpayer expense to bail out the insurance companies. ABC reports that the effects of climate change, while important, are not the primary concern in the short to medium term. Based on analysis of the World Risk Index, a report by the United Nations University in Germany finds that for many of the larger countries in the Southeast Asia region, for example, the rate of land subsidence due to poor groundwater extraction policies are more important drivers of habitat loss than sea level rise. According to the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, U.S. weather stations reported more than 48 tornadoes to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration between 22 and 29 April. A new weather satellite to be launched in October will be equipped with an image scanning algorithm that will provide accurate prediction of tornadoes by identifying overshooting tops, the name given to the vertical updrafts in the cumulonimbus cloud patterns that spawn tornadoes, reports the Weather Network. Meanwhile, the Minnesota Star Tribune reports an unusually calm spring season and predicts a somewhat warmer than usual summer as the strong El Niño gives way to a weak La Niña. In the wake of the release of the documentary Climate Hustle, the politicization of climate science was escalated when Bill Nye the Science Guy called for the arrest of deniers. While Weather Channel founder John Coleman was correct in comparing Nye's arrogant declaration to the persecution of Galileo, as reported in the Christian Post and elsewhere, such a comparison will only validate the defensiveness of the deniers. Furthermore, and on the other hand, this level of discourse further diminishes my confidence in the Weather Channel. What a great way to win hearts and minds, not. The National Review says that the increase in atmospheric carbon dioxide is a good thing because plants thrive on it and plants make oxygen. Well, good. All those combustion engines and wildfires will be needing that oxygen, right? So maybe the next dominant species will be corn. The Elko Nevada Free Press reports on a new earthquake prediction algorithm that uses stress measurements as input in the same way as an application that can identify songs on the internet. I opened with India, and I'll close with more from India, this time a report from the Navin Times on biometeorology, the science of the link between our shared biosphere and our shared atmosphere, that deals with the changes in behavior of populations and communities in anticipation to changes in the weather. Weaver ants, for example, have begun their foraging activities early, a predictor of an early monsoon. Another important species is the firefly, whose normal season is mid-May to mid-November, but which had all but disappeared by October last year, again predicting an early monsoon. Finally, the silk cotton tree has accelerated its seed and leaf production to beat an early monsoon, despite a delayed and reduced flowering. Thanks for following Sequitur on Expressions of Peace Radio. Until next time, this is Susan Livingston.
Connects us is one.